I'm going to turn it over to Somik, who is going to introduce our guest and lead us through a wonderful conversation with Prasad. So, Somik, please take it away.
Hi, everyone. This is my great privilege to introduce our guest speaker, Prasad Kaipa, who I have known both personally and professionally. In fact, I met him when I just graduated from school, and he mentored me for a while. And then when I started working in my present workplace, he also came in as our facilitator for a strategy workshop. So I got to see him in action and see a little bit of his magic. So I'm hoping we can get into that magic that he creates in a lot more depth in this call. So Prasad has a very, very interesting life trajectory. He is a physicist by training, and at a certain point in his life, he decided he was very motivated to get the Nobel Prize in physics, and that shifted, and he joined Apple. And when he was at Apple, he was very much into international marketing and Apple University, and he learned a lot in that phase of his life as well. And then he realized that his real passion was people. And that's when he shifted again and got more into consulting, or should we say management, and organizational helping. And in that phase, I mean, I would say that he's actually a very remarkable consultant. He's one of the few people I know who does almost no marketing or no advertising for his services. And yet he is extremely sought after in every industry. And he just creates magic wherever he goes. So the way I would characterize his magic is he has this peculiar ability where he listens very, very deeply and very authentically to people. And when he figures out that this is an area where you really need help, and when you least expect it, he will suddenly give you a very provocative or a very powerful step forward. I mean, it almost feels like getting a helpful punch to shake us out of our sleep and take some positive steps forward. And he does it so amazingly well that I've been very fascinated by that. So that's a little bit of a personal introduction to Prasad. And I'm going to start by asking him to reflect on something. And to introduce this, I'm going to share with you, he's very thoughtful in his words, and so he characterizes himself in a very interesting language. So he says that his lifelong passion has been to ignite the genius within individuals, organizations, and himself, and he plays multiple roles. And the five roles that he's enumerated are: first is sage on the stage, where he'll give keynote speeches, he's an educator, and he uses provocation as the means to ignite. He's also a guide on the site, where he'll do executive coaching and mentoring and use evocation as the means to ignite. The third role he plays is a monk in a cave, and by that, he sees that as being an author, a thought leader, using reflection and integration of ideas, actions, and feelings to ignite his own genius. The fourth is being a player on the court, where he is a part of a team and he's helping the team achieve greatness, ignite their own genius. And the last one, which is also extremely interesting, which is being at home, where he's a father, a husband, and a friend, appreciating others for who they are and not for what they do and don't do. So these are five beautiful roles that he plays, which and he smoothly transitions between them. So my first question to you, Prasad, is when you started your journey, I have reached out to many people who've known you. So some of these questions actually come from people who know you and love you very much. So the first question is, how did you move from focusing on being a saint on the stage? And I've known that you've often compared yourself, or at that phase in your life, you've felt moved to follow the footsteps of people like Deepak Chopra. And how do you expand from that to these other four, which are so beautiful and so deep, like guide on the side in particular? So can you share something about that journey?
Sure, Somik. Thank you for the question. I I started out with a lot of arrogance and, to think that I could go after something like a Nobel Prize and aspiring for it and arrogantly thinking I can create a pathway to get it by working with or talking to Nobel laureates. Similarly, for me, lots of jealousy, greed, arrogance led, much of my initial part of life. And over time, I'm trying to reduce their role in my life. And part of it was when somebody told me, you can do this and you should charge certain amount of money and you can compete in this area. I took it very seriously and I tried to be the best I can, giving the talks on the stage or charging a large amount of money for it. Somewhere along the path, it became very clear to me that it doesn't matter how much I compete, how much I try to do something to be the best I can. It is a game that I can never win, number one. Number two, more I win, I had more dissatisfaction. I was actually accepting less of myself. And it was a race which was creating enormous amount of stress. And I was completely externally directed. Somewhere along the path, I think almost about 15 years ago or 13 years ago, I began to realize I could achieve what I want out there, but I will be like somebody else's version of myself. There will be no authenticity. There will be no me, and there is no heart left in my pursuit. So around that time, I began to look at it and say, who am I? What do I do? How can I be myself instead of trying to become Deepak Chopra, or trying to become a Nobel laureate, trying to become somebody else, which is like external set of measures. On that path, I began to realize in many areas where I am a failure, where I have not paid attention to, where I really didn't care about, but that is where I have actually heart. That is where I have opportunity to not aspire, not try to challenge myself, not stretch, but actually bring all of myself to other people. So I was able to tap into compassion. I was able to tap into empathy. And what was amazing was people connected where I was running away from, where I was actually quietly saying, I'm not good enough. I can't do this. I don't know how to do that. Go away. And those are the places where people said, we want you. Wherever you are coming from, that place of not knowing, not wanting to be a star, not wanting to be what you call a sage or a leader, that's the place where we want you to come and help us to accept and engage with us. So that was the part where I began to engage more and more and more. I have made some progress. I still struggle with the same things, but my path of journey or transformation has been to go into, like in the initial stage, some of you said, the path to the head is through the heart. Path to recognition is through acceptance of my own vulnerability. At last, Doug Dingelbart, another person whom I had a lot of interaction, who just passed away last week, he was saying the amount of learning you can do is always directly proportional to the amount of vulnerability that you are willing to experience. These are some things that I live by these days. And whenever I'm heady, it doesn't work. Whenever I don't know, I'm open, I'm receptive, I'm willing to be part of somebody else's life and allowing them to be who they are, it looks like magic shows up.
Oh, that was fascinating. So I'm going to build up a little bit on that. So as you mentioned, you bring your whole self to everything that you do. And one thing I've noticed, which is very, I'm not sure if strange is the right word, is that I haven't really seen that many people out there who bring in wisdom from the ancient traditions as you do. And I've even read some of your papers and writings where you will draw wisdom from India's ancient traditions, like from the Mahabharata or the Vedanta scriptures, and you connect it and make it very real in terms of existing management or organizational problems. Now, that's almost sort of a sacrilegious territory, if you will, that bringing in things that many people consider as religious, but you've managed to extract it in a way that no one gets offended, and people, in fact, I believe you've even been invited to give that that perspective at famous universities. So can you share a little bit about that experience, and how do you pull that off?
Sure. It was, again, provocation by somebody else. When I was in Apple as a research fellow at that time, we were looking at how people learn, how people think, how people create. So as a part of that, I ended up interviewing and visiting large number of extraordinary people. That's where my interaction with very special people who have accomplished a lot happened. As a part of it, I had visited one gentleman from Israel, Reuven Feuerstein. And he's a gentleman who works with the Down syndrome kids and who has taught a large number of teachers on what is called mediated learning, so that the entire family of people with the Down syndrome illness could actually live much more productively and intelligently. When I was working with him and when I was learning from him, one day he had asked me to look at a certain Sanskrit quote. And he asked me, do you know what it means? And can you translate it for me? Because I have grown up with a certain amount of Sanskrit while I was growing up, I was able to translate it. And I told him, this is from Patanjali Yoga Sutras, and this is what it means. He looked at me strangely and said, many people don't seem to understand this, but you seem to know. Can you tell me a little bit more about it? So I gave him, you know, a little bit of talk with my own lot of pride and arrogance. I explained some of the things about Yoga Sutra and the Eightfold Path and all of it. He listened to me and he kept quiet. And the next day, as I was leaving, he turns towards me and says, Prasad, you are wasting your life. You know, you came and spent time with me, and you spent time in the operating theaters of brain surgeons. All what you are learning is from outside. But you see, you have forgotten your roots. You are trying to be more American, like many Indians try to do these days. In that process, you have forgotten your Indian roots. I was a little shocked by that. And I asked him, what do you mean by that? Can you elaborate and help me to understand the context for it? He told me, I showed you a principle from Yoga Sutras, which is actually the foundation for my entire work on Down syndrome. The mediation of learning happens when you look at who is the person who is learning, what is it that they are striving to learn, and what is the process of engagement. These three are called triputi in your language, and the idea of the learner, and the process of learning, and the person whom they are trying to worship so that they can learn that from other people are part of your tradition. You understand that. But you don't know diddly squat about what it really means in life. And so you can give me a beautiful lecture on the Patanjali Yoga Sutras, probably very nicely, but you don't even put it to practice in your own life. And whereas I am a guy who took just a few principles and I can apply it, and my entire practice revolved around creating meaning for 50,000 people. So he told me, somewhere you lost yourself. And that kind of triggered something. And similarly, there was another feedback from Lazanov and Barzakov, some of the people from Bulgaria, who told me that they use some of the Indian principles in training large number of East European and Russian and some of the people to excel, athletes to excel. So then I heard some of those, and I got a feeling that I have run away from what I have learned as essence before I got into physics, before I got into computers and technology. I began to, for past 22, 23 years, relearn and reacquaint myself from the, you know, the, and started drinking from the wisdom of various Upanishads, various Buddhist texts, various, stories from the Indian wisdom. And this time, instead of reading them and learning them for just my own entertainment or spiritual growth, I started applying them in working with my clients, because I'm not interested in religious or spiritual for spiritual sake. I'm interested in how can they transform who we are? How can we actually apply it wherever we are? And I found that many of the principles are eminently practical, and they give significant insight. That's the reason why even my book, From Smart to Wise, the framework comes from Bhagavad Gita. Simple six principles I saw from Bhagavad Gita, and I interviewed large number of CEOs, and then telling the stories, and through stories, elaborating the principles, and then giving guidelines and practices for people to put it in their own life. That is the way in which I found the story, the what you call application, and the underlying values can come alive. This is my way of what you might call the aligning head and the heart and the hands. And I have been trying this out for 23 years, and I think I'm making some progress, and there is a large amount of alignment. And of course, I should also say, recently, I have gone back to looking at the neurology and the cognitive sciences. It is beautiful to see much of what is being discovered in the neurological paradigm parallel what has been written up in the ancient texts, not only in India, but also in what you call Judaism or Zen, or Abrahamic religions like Christianity or Islam. I think the key part is practicing it, and not just practicing it blindly as a ritual, but stepping back and looking at how do I apply the underlying spirit of the principle, and then staying with it till it becomes part of who I am. I think that's what I am trying, and I'm finding, what you call large amount of my own transformation in the process of applying these with other people.
Oh, that was amazing. Thank you, Prasadji, for reflecting on that. Yeah. I want to ask you a question that I received from, again, one of your close friends, which connects to this point. Mm-hmm. So the question is this, that you've received this advice from this Israeli mentor or the person you interviewed, and it really transformed your life. Mm-hmm. But the better question is, should one trust his or her teacher/guru and follow their advice, even if it seems illogical or counterintuitive?
Excellent point. I have had this difficulty with my own friend and teacher, Dr. Mohan Rao, for a long period of time. I found many of his insights and recommendations are not only counterintuitive, they are outright, he tells me to stop things which I think are important. Like when I was writing the book, Discontinuous Learning, there was an entire group of people who created that book, and they created a publishing company to publish it, and it was almost ready. But then my teacher said to me, don't publish it. And then I said, okay, I will not publish it, but I have spent so much of time, I will give it away freely. Then he looked at me and said, selling the book at least will get you something. Now you are feeding your subtle ego by giving it away because you think you are such a generous, great person that, you know, people are, you know, you are giving away your knowledge freely. What a wonderful guy. It is about feeding your ego. In the beginning, I was actually really upset with his comments. But over time, I realized how I give is more important than what I give. You know, generosity is remarkable if I can come from the heart and if I can do it with such a wonderful sense of gratitude and certain ability to give it from my heart. You know, that is the story which is talked about quite a bit in something called Kathopanishad. But in my life, similarly, when I went to ISB and wanted to start a center, my teacher told me, this is not important. It is not what you start, how many things you get. You know, yes, it's great that you raised $7 million and you started this center of leadership. This is not where you will find happiness. You know, you need to go back to just being yourself and coming from inside. And his advice was, whatever you do, can you give 100% results with what you do for at least 80% of the people whom you work with? Or at least 80% of the results that you promise for 100% of the people whom you work with? If you cannot do it, don't do it. Or don't charge money for it. That was something which was very counterintuitive. I said, look, I'm an academic. Sometimes what I tell, I can't practice it. Then he said, don't tell that. I said, well, I need to write papers. These are intellectual papers. These are not about practicing. He said, then stop doing that intellectual work. So he has been ruthless with me. But even though in the beginning I went against his stuff, over a period of time I found out that trust which you brought, Somik, the idea of trust is the only thing that can open my heart, and trust is the only motivational force that connects one another. And if I lose that trust, or in the spiritual context, the faith in oneself and faith in each other, without the faith and without the trust, it doesn't matter what you do, it will fall off very quickly. So it is not the intellectual stuff that remains with me, even though I struggle and I try hardest to be intellectually sharp and good, but most of my learning seems to come from, am I creating trust? Or am I having faith? Even if all the results show things are not happening, do I still have faith in myself and faith in other people? Those became the life-giving forces. And they're not easy. I'm still struggling with them. You know, probably 50% of the time I can operate from trust. You know, like as I was listening, one of the people, I think, you know, what you call Jay, was telling me about telling us about Peace in the Park Festival. He said he did not make any money, but he has been very creative. I think what you need to have, again, is trust and faith that you have a great opportunity to let go what you have been very good at in technology. But if you can trust yourself and trust the universe, I have a feeling opportunities will come up that would include who you have been and transcend to a new self. And of course, it is difficult for the mind to hold on to it. But whenever you hold on, you seem to be surprised and you seem to be gratified. So that's what I keep believing.
Wow. Thank you so much again. I mean, I'm just very grateful to be hearing this. Well, I'm going to ask you a deeply personal question, and this is coming from my experience with you as a facilitator last year in our company, where you had us do an exercise, mm-hmm. Where you asked us to reflect on who our role models were. And I remember I was putting names of people who are not alive anymore. And then I remember being surprised seeing who your role models were. And you had one name there, which was your wife's name.
Mm-hmm.
And this connects to your being at home role in your life. So can you share, and I know that your wife has faced cancer and has made it through.
Yeah.
So how has that changed you, and how do you see her as your role model?
Three ways. Because I came to United States first, and because I'm always much more talkative and I'm in the world, I used to think I'm her teacher. You know, she needs to listen and she needs to practice and work with me. And over a period of time, I actually was invisible to her contributions at some level. And so we had our own ups and downs, but somewhere along the path, I began to realize what I try to do with 100 words, she does it with one look. She does it with one action. And somehow, whatever are counterintuitive, whatever I try to teach and tell everybody else, it is like she accepts it and does it in one, you know, sweep. And whatever I try so many times to change my discipline and practice, once she says, I'll do it, she just does it. So I wondered about all of those. And when she was going through her own illness and then recovering from it, I began to realize the strength for her comes from, again, certain faith, number one. Number two, small steps every day taken with 100% commitment and with all of her heart. You know, she does it with a lot of, you know, boring, mundane, routine, daily stuff. But she does it with such a sense of alignment between the head and the heart and the hands. It is like I found out when she does something, it nurtures people. It actually makes people feel fulfilled. They feel like they are fed. When she feeds something, you just don't get the food. You get the love that she put into preparing that food. Or when she says something, you can feel that she thought through it a lot and she really wanted to say some things. And if I don't listen to it, I may never get to hear that again because she is more introverted and she does not say a lot of words. That doesn't make it easy because I am an extroverted person and I am a chatterbox. But it is whenever I pay attention, and of course, most of the times because she is, you know, exactly opposite of my personality, I don't like what she says. Whatever she says, it has to go against my grain. But whenever I did follow some of it, almost inevitably 100% of the time, I come back learning something which I would have never learned, or having an insight into something I would have never seen. So from that perspective, I realized I am not her teacher. She is actually my teacher. Similarly, it is not my kids that I need to teach. I can facilitate and I can be. But my children, you know, like my daughter went off at the age of 22 to go around the world all by herself, you know, after her graduation. And she is learning some things I have not yet learned. I'm 57. So I have a feeling that when I can look at my family and friends and see what is it that I can take away from them. It doesn't matter how many faults or how many strengths they have, but what can I learn and what can I accept? That seems to be the only way I can influence them, as well as I can actually learn from them and grow in areas I would have never learned if I were not to listen to them.
Wow. Okay, Prasadji. So this is coming from another good friend of yours.
Mm-hmm.
And this is asking you to reflect on one event. I knew you've shared a couple already, so maybe this is covered, but I just wanted to try again because each time I ask you, you come up with some gems. So can you share one event that initiated your own inner transformation? And now as you reflect, that was the biggest hurdle that was holding you back.
There was a leadership program I was taking. And in that particular program, I kept on showing up like, you know, the know-it-all. You know, I was always proud of being a walking encyclopedia. I was always proud of trying to show up with a lot more answers for people. So my whole life revolved around having the answers so that I can be the smartest guy wherever I go. And in this particular program, more answers I gave, more answers I tried to come up with, it felt more and more empty at some level. And towards the end, I realized I have answers from the past, answers from other people, but none of them I'm coming from my own reflection. I'm actually not a very reflective guy, I found out. I found out I'm more interested in getting approval from other people. I'm interested in looking good in front of other people. I'm interested in impressing other people. But there is not much that I had really deeply come from who I am. And so in some respects, I found out I may be known to a lot of people, but I don't know myself. And I have a very limited ability to get out of my own stuckness, get out of my own problems. And more I try to put on a show for other people, less I'm actually engaging with who I am and what I bring. So at that time, I began to say, you know, it is not what I do that is important. It is not what I say that is important. I need to look at, can I actually get some small set of disciplines and practices that will allow me to break out of my own stuckness? And I think that is something that is some, you know, very, very powerful. Just as I was talking, my son, who is visiting me from Los Angeles this weekend, he just came in and gave me just a small hug and a kiss on my head. That means a lot to me than any other accolade which I get from outside. I think if I can get that closer connection with another human being, one moment at a time, one incident at a time, it is not about I impressing other people, but being inspired by other people. I think that is where I have grown and I continue to grow. Of course, it is not easy. You know, being wise is something that is about giving up the smartness for the larger good. Doesn't mean I won't be smart anymore, but it is a question of looking at it and saying, how am I serving others? And how am I contributing to other people? I think if I can hold those on my radar as a way to know whether I am making progress in my life or not, I found that is something that can be very meaningful. And that's what came out of that incident which happened. I've been trying to practice it ever since. I think I almost made about 10% progress. I have only 90% to go.
You're extremely humble. I'm going to ask one more quick question building up on that since you brought up smart to wise. So going through your book, I remember like from, with the provocative title, like from smart to wise, like, okay, finally someone's going to tell us how do we shift and how do we become wise. And what I noted reflecting on was you actually didn't have a way of how people could become wise, but the point of your book was there's no substitute for the hard work for each individual in their specific context. Can you say more about that? Have I understood this correctly?
Sure. Definitely, moving from smart device, if I take my own life or what I wrote in the book, requires certain amount of unlearning and selective forgetting. What it means is like prioritization. Like, you know, some of the people mentioning, I think it was Bela from Berkeley who mentioned about the free food being given to the employees. At some level, the employer, the president saying, it is not about what I tell other people. It is not about what is important to me, or intimidating, offering resources. Some of it doesn't work. But when some people began to go and eat off of other people's plates, that touched something much, much, much deeper. So, of course, you can look at it and say, oh my God, I don't know whether I could do that. But when I recognize some people went beyond their own identity and ego and their own self, whatever limitations they have to be able to even offer that, that is something that seems to open up the wisdom in not only those people, but also other people. I do have 6 principles, which I do talk about from Bhagavad Gita. And of course, it also has an empirical roots. It is about shifting the perspective from what is in it for me to what is in it for other people. And then acting consistent with the shifted perspective as much as possible. Can I, when I am conscious, when I am aware, can I do what my heart tells me to do, even though it may not look good? Or, and then can I, like, for example, even, you know, when you said I'm humble, I, for a moment, I had to reflect and say, am I being humble to put on a nice show? Or am I actually being humble because I'm being authentic? I had to ask myself, if I'm putting on a show of false humility, other people may be impressed, but it won't make an iota of difference in my own growth. So recognizing who am I being when I'm doing certain actions? And how am I discerning? You know, like as I mentioned, whatever I'm sharing with you, are they appropriate to be shared in a larger context when people are not willing to respect the privacy? So I need to have the discernment to know what to say when. Authenticity doesn't mean you can share everything to everybody without knowing how they will respect it. And then similarly, the wisdom is also about knowing how far and how long you go doing some project because you believe in it. And then when do you hold on and when do you let go? If you have a larger purpose, it becomes a lot easier to know those kinds of questions. And finally, can I do something with an enlightened self-interest or even selfless interest? Like, that is where people like Nipun and Viral have inspired me for a long period of time. You know, when I met with Nipun last week, he was talking about how when people are willing to pay like large amount of money and first-class travels, where he said, you know what, I don't need that. He could have given it to a charity, but he said, it is not my charity. I don't want even an iota of connecting with it. And it is appropriate for me to let them do whatever they want to do without I getting involved in it. I, you know, that was very, very inspiring for me. So there are principles which can be used appropriately and with discernment that can help us to act wisely. But it is important to remember, wisdom is our birthright. Somewhere over a period of time, we get socialized and conditioned to be smart in one context, in workplace or in home. We try to put on a show that looks good and that will get us the kudos in the short term, but it is ephemeral, it is temporary. If I can pay attention to larger purpose, mutual interest, and do apply my smartness and intelligence But towards what will serve people, I have a feeling that is a definite pathway to wisdom.
Wow.
You know, one question that sort of has come up for me just listening to you speak, Prasad, is that, you know, you've coached, you know, other leaders in various companies and whatnot, you know, in terms of helping them transform themselves. But what if you are in a position where you're not necessarily the leadership? You know, you're a worker in the field, or you're in management or whatnot, but not necessarily the highest level, and yet you still want to affect this change, or you feel stumbling blocks because your boss or whomever might not have that mindset. So how do you shift them from smart leadership to eventually to wise leadership?
I think that you have asked a very important question, Amit. I think it is extremely important to recognize it is not the role you play that is critical. Like I have heard of how Birju, for example, was able to bring a transformation in his entire team. He is not the boss, but he was able to get the boss and other people to start doing some reflection practice or silence practice. I have seen, and even here, Bela sharing about how low-level managers who were able to make a difference in saving the food, or when you talk about, you know, whether it is from Audrey or Prakash, or when I have been hearing various things, I look at it and say, who you think you are, not from the job role, but from the contribution that you want to make. The culture change happens when people take the leadership in the place, in the job, in the role that they play. Because these days, everybody is so focused on just getting the job done, just doing what is smart. Anything that you do that is wise, that is compassionate, that is generous, that is a contribution, will get noticed very quickly. I think because of the diversity and globalization, there is more of a chance for your, you know, positive deviance to be noticed rather than you towing the company line or you being smart as everybody expects you to do. So I recommend, whether you are an individual contributor or a low-level manager, pick a problem, but once you pick a problem that you want to solve, bring your perspective to how can it actually become contribution to other people. See, the key is to see how you can get other people involved in that change. It doesn't matter how good a change it is. If you come in and bring the change and go away, nobody really cares. But if you can figure out a way, I'm coming back to this example because she took time to elaborate this story. I'm talking about Bela. Then, this manager who is also committed, he invited, 20 people, and they decided to make a difference. They were not the president of the company, but they were able to bring the culture change that the president, with all the resources and power and control, could not bring. So that means around us, there are several magical examples. When you step out of what is expected, but what you feel as you have a genuine passion for, and where you are willing to look bad if necessary, where you are willing to take risk, and where you are willing to involve others and make a commitment to, you know, bring some difference, that is where the transformation occurs. You know, like Nipun and I were talking about, the first step is awareness, and that awareness could be created, it doesn't matter, by whoever. Second is creating an impact. So if you are a low-level person, figure out what not only brings awareness, but it creates an impact in a small, measurable way that will be observed a lot more easily and a lot more quickly. Then comes the question of how do you transform, how do you transform other people? And the fourth step, which we were talking about is, how do you actually make that not just a static transformation? If it becomes a dynamic transformation where you continue to stay in touch with the process, that means it brings a culture change. I use the word sustainability for it. Once you bring a change, how do you make it sustainable in the organization over time? It can never be done by one or a small group of people unless they keep on enrolling others who can be inspired by that action, by that vision. Think about it like a Wednesday night sessions or these forest calls or the smile cards. The sustainability is what makes transformation to spread.
Thank you, Prasad.
Hi, Prasad. This is Audrey. I was, while listening to your answers and some of your questions, I was noticing this theme of kind of just doing what your heart wants to do, even if it doesn't look good or even if, you know, it seems against the norm to the outside mm-hmm. world. And I was just wondering if you could share, you know, maybe a moment that where you've done that, where you've done what your heart wants to do, even if it doesn't look good or even if, you know, you're not sure how people will respond.
Sure. Before I give an example from my life, just a little bit of warning. You need to make sure when you talk about your heart, it is not just some emotions that came up in the moment. You need to examine your emotions to see, is there a larger purpose? Is there, are you passionate about it because there is a purpose to be served, or you just feel good about it? You know, so you have to look at both authenticity and appropriateness when you look at the heart. That is extremely important. So I'm not saying just do whatever that comes to your heart and whatever you feel like in a mindless way. So that is important to keep in mind. Now, right? Because without that warning, we can easily mistake doing what your heart wants. Maybe like, you know, like some of these guys who went and did whatever they did and brought a lot of damage to other people around them because they say, hey, I'm just following my heart. I don't care what you think or how much damage it does. Okay, coming back to me, quitting the Apple in 1990 was something that was extremely difficult for me. And I had to do what my heart wanted to do. Because at that time, I was a research fellow at Apple University. I was making significant amount of money. You know, like 23 years ago, that was something really remarkable. And I didn't have a job that was available. And I didn't know anything about organizational change. There was no field called executive coaching. I didn't know what it means to be a change agent. But at that time, I felt I need to get out of Apple and actually pursue my own personal transformation. I needed to really see what is this that I can learn about myself, not being a technology guru or not being a professor, but actually learning and leading and then seeing how I can put food on the table. That was difficult because after about a year, I had $22,000 in my bank and I have two kids at that time. My daughter was just born in 1990. Even that $22,000 came because my 401k or some other retirement stuff, which I had put it in Apple, they found out that I have quit Apple, but they had not given it back to me. So they gave it back, and so I had to pay like a 10% penalty, but that's all I had. And I was not making any money at all. And so I decided at the end of this 22,000, either I will go back to India and with my family and look up something else and see what happens. So I stayed with my heart because at that time, the guy who brought me into Apple, one Keith Allan, who was a recruiter, he came back and got me, I mean, in interview in Adobe to be a product line manager and to direct the Photoshop series of products. And he said to me, you know, after the interview, the job is yours if you stop talking about, you know, transformation in the world and how this learning requires, you know, learning and innovation, and some of these need to be transformed and people have to look inside out, you know, in addition to outside in. If you can cut out all this stuff for next 2 years, the job is yours. And it was like $150,000 salary, a director level position, you know, all of that was good. I thought about it. And I asked my wife, and she wanted me to take the job because we were concerned about some other stuff. But I decided, no, I'm not going to do it. And it was like I got everybody telling me that's a wrong thing to do. But I have had 1 year to think about. I realized if I give up what I was doing, I will literally die. You know, my head may be present, my body may be awake, but inside I will be dead. But interestingly, within 2 months, there was a guy called Ravi Sahai, who used to work in Xerox. He came in and opened a door for me to do some programs on learning and creativity in Xerox. I went and did one program, and they got so impressed with it for whatever that came out, they gave me like 20 program contract. And next thing I know, I am on my way to become a workshop leader and a program leader, and that completely was a turnaround. So I had to trust my heart, and but of course I had to keep my eyes open in trusting my heart as well.
Thank you.
Somik and Prasadji, thank you for gifting us this wonderful conversation. That moment, Prasadji, that you shared with your son really deeply touched. Thank you for, you know, sharing that. Amit, I have quite a few thoughts and questions. Please stop me. It starts from ranges anywhere from tennis to book to and some insights about parenting. So, yeah, please do stop me if there are more callers. So I guess I'll start with this idea, Prasadji, about on this book, the recent book. So what has been, I was going to ask you to zoom in on maybe one or two real-life incidents from the book tour, talking to people, connecting to the people with the book as an instrument. If there are any insights and any transformation stories that you wanted to share with the community, I wanted to, you know, open it up for that. The other second aspect was, you know, as you were sharing your insights with your son, this is an experience we've been having at home with a 6 month old that you can hear in the background. So this morning, as you were sharing, this is what happened. I was you know, she woke up and she was just playing by all herself, this 6 month old, and this is like the experience of every day. I just popped my head up around her tiny bed. Out of the blue, she just made this huge sound, and the brilliant smile really filled my heart, and that's been the. You know, so it was so wonderful for my wife to witness that too. It's like no words were exchanged, but there's a smile spreading all around. And I think Bela and Audrey and Kanchan, they can relate because we are so thankful that they visited us recently. They can relate to her this smile and the play. So the first question was the inspiring moments from the book, and the second was about your. I heard about your love for tennis, and I wanted to zoom in on that and see what have you been learning from tennis, and what is your story with the tennis. Thank you.
Okay. The inspiring moment was, even though I have been wanting to write this, book, and it has been difficult because I can express myself a lot more easily in conversation, and it is a lot harder for me to put it in writing because this field is something that I have acquired, not through college, not through writing essays, not through some of it. As Somik mentioned, I'm a physicist who is doing something in the human area, human resources area. So it makes it a lot harder for me to write any papers or write blogs or some of them in the beginning. And even now I have the difficulty, but to start it is much harder. So I find it like this guy, Navi Raju, with whom we wrote large number of blogs in HBR, he comes in and then I ask him, you know, would you help me to write this book on leadership? And then he says, well, I don't know anything about leadership, but if you can teach me to become a leader, then I will help you to write it. So it became a very nice one to put it in a narrative context. In the Indian story Mahabharata, Vedavyas was asked to write Mahabharata because it is actually his own family story. And when he wanted to write it, he wanted to make sure his own emotions, his own personal bias doesn't come into picture. So he wanted to write it, but he wanted somebody else to be the script writer for him. So he invited Ganesh, Lord Ganesh, in Indian context, to be the person who writes it down while Vyas is elaborating it in words, just like Navi and myself. So the condition Ganesh put is, you have to speak it without thinking through, without letting your emotions color it. You have to speak as fast as I can write it down. And of course, Vyas said, I may not be able to think and do, but you have to think and understand what I'm saying before you write it down. So those became the conditions under which the Mahabharata got written up. What is amazing is those exactly were the conditions that happened for Navi and me. And because whenever we talked and whenever we created an outline, whenever we talked about interview or story to be put in, Navi comes up and says, no, man, this doesn't make sense. Or he will say, I can't relate to it. What the hell are you talking about? And how am I going to practice this? Or it doesn't make any sense to me. And I, you know, what you are saying is Greek and Latin to me. Of course, in the beginning, I was like saying, oh my God, if you were to be in my field, you would understand. Or if you were to know what I'm talking about, you would not say this story should be removed from the book. But then I realized, actually, he was giving me the biggest gift anybody can give. That is, he's actually being the reader for me right up front. And he's actually saying, if I can't understand this, how can reader who is picking up a book and who might never know you and who might have no experience with you will ever understand what you are talking about? So it was an extraordinarily rich scenario for me that he contributed so much for this book to be what it is, and for which I'm eternally grateful. And a quick comment on the tennis is, like, whenever I play tennis, I realize it is all about being in the moment and being present. If I try to beat myself up on one day because I'm not able to pay attention to it, it doesn't work. What I'm doing on the court is a reflection of how I am living my life outside of that court. So I look at it as a tennis meditation. So in the 1 hour, I look at it and say, am I paying attention to the ball? Am I actually being with the ball as it comes? Or am I strategizing where the ball should go rather than where my body is and where the ball is coming? And instead of sending it, whenever my head gets in the way, it doesn't work. At some level, I realized tennis is all about developing a discipline. It is not the shots that you make. It is not the wonderful drop shots or something else for you to get the point. But it is about consistency, repeatedly doing same old boring thing again and again and again so that you can keep the ball in play. It is like life has to be in play. It is not about who wins or who loses. You know, there's an excellent book called Finite and Infinite Games by James Kars. It's an old book. It's a small book. It says you can play the game like a finite game. You came into the world. You chose tennis. There is a beginning. There is an end. There is a way to score. There is you. There is an opponent. All of this is fine. But life is like an infinite game. When you came into the world, you don't know what game you are playing, who is on your team, what are the rules of the game called life, and can they be changed? In the end, you know, when you go away, the game continues. This is the game in which you came in the middle, you go out in the middle. But if you can make a contribution, you can move, you know, something forward through your generosity, through your passion and purpose, through you contributing to somebody else's life, I feel game might not have moved, but you have moved. I think that's what I keep learning every day in tennis. It sets me the tone for rest of the day. We don't play games, by the way. We just rally. But it teaches me so much about where is my head, where is my body, and how much am I striving to get my heart with the aligned with the heart, head and the body.
Thank you, Prasad. I think, you know, we have just one more question, or time for one more question before we have to wrap up the call. So I'm going to go to our final question. And Prakash, thank you for that great question.
Hi, this is Michelle Ehlers calling in from Santa Fe.
Hi, Michelle.
I just want to thank you so much for the reminder. I am definitely one of the people that goes around in the world being smart. And today is a good day to get the reminder that it's not all about being smart, that there's something else to come from. So thank you so much for that. The question that I have today is, what do you see yourself taking on in the future? What's exciting you for your next challenge, so to speak? What's calling to you to explore, either for the world or for yourself or for both?
Very good question, Michelle. Thank you for that. What I'm seeing is, you know, there are three ways in which I found any story can be meaningful. You know, my story, our story, and what is happening in the moment. You know, what is the story of the world in this particular moment? These are the three things. When they combine together, there is an opportunity for transformation. So when I wrote this book, because it took like 20 years of working with various people and 2 years of interviews to write it, but I found out while there seems to be some momentum building up, there are some wisdom circles that are forming and people are actually reading it together one chapter at a time and trying to apply it in their life before they go to the next chapter. So there is an alignment coming around there. But what is also amazing is lots of people go back to smartness saying, you know, this is good, but when I become older or when I become, you know, CEO or when I do something else, I need wisdom. Because I'm too young to really think about wisdom, I will focus on smartness right now. So what is exciting for me is to recognize that writing the book, I thought I got my job done. But I'm actually realizing the job began after I write the book, because what is it that stops people to be continually seduced by the shadow side of smartness? Recognizing for me, and that recognizing that smartness is very good, but it has to serve a larger purpose. So I'm finding that probably in next 2 or 3 or 4 years, I'll have to keep on working with very smart people to keep on helping them and myself to repurpose their smartness in such a way that it can pay off for themselves and for the world at the same time. So I think I see myself also learning from the book. Now that I wrote the book, people expect me to be wise. I say I'm a student of wisdom. I say I have a lot more ways to go. You know, there is an assessment I have, but if I take the same assessment I put out on am I being a wise leader, I can keep seeing the gaps. So I have a lot of work to do in terms of practicing and actually acting on the book that I wrote. So to summarize, this book I wrote for myself to learn and practice much more than, you know, other people to get the value out of it. And I'll be grateful if other people can get the value. But I have a lot of work to do to make sure I'm living in alignment with some of the principles and some of the deeper stories that I have been privileged to hear and document.
Thank you very much, Chris. Thank you.